Why are police photographing our license plates?
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Welcome to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. I'm Marcello Rolando. The mission of the Reasonable Voice is to connect the dots between politics and finance, the need for better and more affordable education, our humanity, world peace, and of course, the arts, which we then gladly provide our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination and appetite for equal opportunity. The Reasonable Voices are advocates prioritizing education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world by evoking and embracing the creative artist and political unity as solutions to our challenges. Welcome to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. My guest today is Diego Ungaro. Is Ungaro, is that correct?
Ungaro,
good. Who is a writer, director, who has done a lot of things, but most notably perhaps now is that he and his film, Bob and the Trees, have been invited to be a part of the Sundance Festival in January and February 2015. Welcome to the show, Diego.
Thank you very much, Marcello. I'm glad to be here.
Good. Did I get all the facts right? Are you going to Sundance?
Yeah, that's it. I hope I will. I'm very excited about that.
That is something to be excited about. You know, we hear about Sundance all the time, and I know you and I know, and Robert Redford in Utah and all that, but can you tell us what's been your experience with Sundance? What do you know? Introduce Sundance to those who don't know.
I will tell you as much as I know, which is not a lot, actually, because I've never been there.
Yeah.
It's going to be my first time bringing a film there, and I've never been even like as an audience there.
Uh-huh.
I've tried many times sending a previous short film that I did, but never, even I came close with the last one, I didn't make it in. So the only thing is I know is that it's tremendous chance for a filmmaker to be there, and that I was barely hoping to be there.
Yes.
I was hoping, but I didn't think we had a lot of chance, and we made it, so that's terrific. As part of the festival, I mean, aside from the fact that it's the most prestigious film festival in North America,
yes.
I mean, I would say like probably the second in the world after Cannes in France. I mean, that's a tremendous opportunity for Robin the Trees, my film, and for me as a filmmaker for the rest of my career. I mean, it might be a once in a lifetime kind of thing, so I don't want to miss out on it.
Yes. Well, it's an exciting possibility even to be considered, and my congratulations to you. I know people who have been involved in the festival, and it's it's difficult to talk about until a month or so after you're finished. That's what I always hear. So, but it won't be your first. It may be your biggest, but it won't be your first film festival. Including Bob and the Trees did the Maryland Film Festival. Yes.
Yeah, that's correct. So basically this is a feature film, but 4 years ago I shot a short film which bears the same name, Bob and the Trees.
Yes.
It was about 28 minutes long, and it's sort of a blueprint for that film. Basically, it stars the same character, Bob, who's a logger in real life and in the film as well, and Matt, his son, who works with him. And we made that film in 2010. And I was very excited with the result, and what we were able to do with this film, and it did very well in film festival, mostly in the U.S. and in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And Yeah, it's screened at the Maryland Film Festival, and I got a lot of really good feedback from people. People were really excited about this film and the fact that it talks about loggers that is sort of underexposed in cinema. You really see loggers in film, and about a certain type of American people that
sure.
also are not very exposed in cinema usually. So I had really the sense that people were very excited about the project, which I was excited about the project too, and I wanted to tell more stories about Bob, and that led me to create a bigger film out of it, make it a feature film.
Feature length, yes. Well, let's talk a bit about you. You are a French director living in rural Western Massachusetts of Italian descent. Tell us about that.
I'm half Italian, though.
It's
also an Italian name. My father is Italian, and my mom is French, and I grew up in France most of the time. My father is 100% Italian.
So okay.
I speak French and Italian, and English now.
Yes, and doing very well. Multilingual and everything.
Yeah,
but you're living in rural Western Massachusetts, which is where Bob and the Trees takes place, yes?
Yeah, I'm living in the town we shut the film in. Uh-huh. Tiny town in the Berkshires, called Fansfield. I have 700 people, and the town is large town. I mean, size-wise, it's about twice the size of there. Or 700 people. So there is a lot of trees, a lot of forests, and not a lot of houses. And it's very pretty, very scenic, with lakes and forests and brooks, and it's beautiful. It's a truly beautiful area. That's why I'm still living there 8 years after moving in.
And it also, judging by your film, Bob and the Trees, it's a lot of snow as well, at least in winter, huh?
Yeah, winters are something. I mean, they're as beautiful as they are, it's an intense experience. I mean, especially not having grown up in this area. I mean, I grew up in Paris, so I'm not familiar with, like, really harsh,
yes.
cold climate like these.
Yes.
And we do get a lot of snow. And I think in Rock Haven, so we do get, like, 4 solid months of winter, even 5 sometimes. And it's cold, and you get cabin fever. It's intense. It's an experience.
Yeah.
It's hard. I mean, on the long run, it's hard. Like, when springtime comes and you still have snow on the ground and it's still cold, you're just like, wow. You want to get out.
What do? Do you head south for a bit?
Yeah, you try to. I think something smart is always trying to get away for a week or two if you can, like somewhere sunny in February or March, like either Florida or wherever. It doesn't really matter, but something with a milder climate
is
usually a smart thing to do, so you kind of break up the winter into.
Yeah, sounds good. It's a plan, yeah. All right. Well, look, some history. In 2005, you wrote and directed Me, My Bag, and My Ball. They're both short films, right, that won awards?
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Yeah, that was my first go at it. I mean, I started working in television, actually. That's how I learned how to use, like, a video camera, learn how to edit, and started. I was actually doing production first, so that's how I got into the business. But I've always wanted to do films. And in 2005, it was a few months before I was actually moving to the States with my wife, who's American.
Uh-huh.
And I gathered with my best friend, who is a graphic designer, and we really wanted to do, like, a little film, like just a short film together.
Uh-huh.
And we had to do it fast because I was taking a plane in 3 months and taking all my stuff with me. So we really wanted to make something together just because we've always wanted to collaborate on something. And so we sort of wrote that story very quickly and shot that over a weekend and put it together.
Uh-huh.
And that made, like, a 7-minute short film, which is very fun and very original, I think. And we finished it right before I flew to the U.S. with my wife and my luggage and stuff.
Wow.
and we landed the biggest short film festival in the world, which is in Clermont-Ferrand.
Yes.
It's a fairly small town in France.
Yes.
And we had tremendous success there for such a small film, because basically the film, like, cost us €300 to make. Shot it over a day and a half, and I edited it from my apartment in Paris. And there we got a really great award, which is it's a grant from Canal Plus.
Yes.
Which gave us €25,000 to make a new film.
Wonderful.
So basically, Yeah, we had the smallest film in the bunch, and we took out all the money and all that. That was money to make another film, though. That had to go to production to make another film. But that was the best gift we could ever have, because it means that yes, we would make another film. And so Thomas, my friend, and I started working on another short film after that, with a bigger budget. It was much more ambitious because we had money this time, and we could afford that.
Fantastic.
And we did a lot of other film festival with the previous film, Me, My Bag, and My Ball. It was really great. People really liked the film.
Excellent. So you write, you direct, you edit. What else? Do you ever get in front of the camera?
I do sometimes. I did a bunch of commercial. I mean, I used to model a little bit when I was in Paris for a few years, and I do voiceover sometimes. I've done a commercial for Warby Parker, that glass brand. I'm very good at it, but sometimes I do it. It's kind of fun. Also, for directors, sometimes
they
need a French guy, or that's, yeah.
Yeah, excellent. What about, you went on to Return to Labradoria.
Yes, Return to Labradoria. That's the film we made with the Canal Plus grant, that money that I was telling you about.
Yes.
Got from the grant in Clermont-Ferrand, and so that was still a film that I did with my friend Thomas Poussin.
Yes.
And we were together. It was sort of a comedy and a science fiction film all together, like really oddball sort of film that tells the story of a salesman that sells firewood over the phone. That gets fired and decides to fly to the planet of Labradoria, which is the matrix planet for Labradors, in hopes to find his long lost Labrador that died a few years ago. So it's sort of a crazy idea on paper that we made it happen. It's a very, very fun and sweet film.
Yes.
And it was much more ambitious with more special effects, because we had to create a planet with living dogs on it. And it was also a longer film. It was like 23 minutes long.
Uh-huh.
And we had a proper crew with about 25 people. It was very interesting to work in this environment. And it was such a different experience from the first short we did, because it was just Thomas and I basically holding the camera and holding a boom, just shooting over a day. the film had a good career too in festivals. So we also went to Clermont-Ferrand and a bunch of other festivals in the U.S. And
the Aspen Short Fest.
Aspen Short Fest. That was really terrific.
Yes.
Such a beautiful festival. It's really great. Festivals are great to screen your film in front of audiences and to meet other directors.
Yes.
Especially me, because I live in the woods. I live in this small town that I was describing, and I don't have much of a filming community. I don't meet directors all the time. It's not like I live in New York or LA or. But film festivals are that great, because I enjoy meeting people and talking and having a little bit of social.
Sure, of course, and winning awards doesn't hurt either.
Yes. So
where you live, I would imagine, is very conducive to your writing. But then going to festivals feeds the director in you. Is that true?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, festivals. I mean, it's great to screen in front of audiences. Like I was saying, it's a once in a lifetime experience. When you work so hard on a film and you have like a big theater. I mean, the one in Clermont-Ferrand, for example, is 1,500 seats.
Uh-huh.
It's giant. And when it's packed with people, and you're 25 years old, and your family's on the screen there, and
yes,
you have, like, goosebumps, your heart is
pounding
out of your chest. I mean, it's, like, it's incredible. So just for that, it's amazing, and you hear people laughing, or not. I mean, if your film sucks, maybe that's going to be terrible, but
yes.
hopefully you won't have to suffer through that. For that, and then watching other people's film is great for inspiration too. I mean, that inspiration so far is watching movies. I just can't get enough of it. That's why I love cinema.
Yes.
And also, meeting people and other filmmakers. It's great because we're like in the independent film community, and people need to help each other, and you need advice, you need people to, yeah, to come help you out when you have a shoot, or, and, yeah, so you can rely to these people. Like, people are pretty tight together usually.
Yes. Film people, well, they're one of a kind, you know. You get up before the sun,
yeah,
and you work until after the sun.
Yep. Yeah. You never really stop. I mean, it's haunting.
It is.
It's like, yeah, it's like any art. I mean, you just live through it.
And, you know, and I love, film still remains my favorite medium. I've done a lot more television, acting in television and directing in theater, but film still remains my number one love. And people ask me, how can you stand all the waiting for the, or the, you know, the takes for the setup of the shot? And for me, that's what's exciting. I love that.
Yeah.
You know.
It is.
Besides, sometimes you have a trailer to wait in, too. So it seems the more films you make, the longer they get. Which is, was that the plan, or you just are you growing into the feature length? Or
yeah, I mean, you are, definitely. I mean, the making feature film was, yeah, it's always something I aspired to.
Sure.
I mean, it's what most people get to see. Short film is amazing, and I love the medium.
Yes.
But at the end of the day, you don't have much of an economy around that. You can't really make a living out of that.
Yes.
And very few people get to see it, get to watch them. So I love them, and I hope, and I'm pretty sure I will keep doing short films. But yeah, I've always wanted to do short, to do feature films.
Sure.
But they do get longer. When, especially with Love in the Trees, the short film, which was about half hour long.
Yes.
It was fun for me to try. It already had like a feature film sort of pace to it.
Uh-huh.
Not a short film, which was very interesting for me because I sort of find my groove there. I was like, wow, this could be like an hour and a half long. It could be if the story expanded. I was there, and it had like a nice slow pace to it that you just like slowly get into, and to me it was very effective. And that's when I said to myself, well, I think I'm ready. I think I'm ready to move to something bigger.
Excellent.
It's a big leap. I mean, it's scary and daunting. I mean, it's not only because it's much more money, because it's also the story you have to hold up for the story with this hour and a half or
even
longer. It's not easy to create.
Exactly. It's quite an arc. The arc grows, as they say. Before we go to a break, tell us about the Milano Film Festival. And is that where you submitted Rice and Meat? Which is a great title.
Yeah, exactly. I can't really tell you much about it because I didn't get to go. I was in the U.S. at that point, and I couldn't fly there. I don't remember why, but I didn't get to go. And the only thing I knew was the film got an award. I was really excited about that. So that's the only thing I can tell you. And the award was really nice because it was basically an invitation to come next year to the Bologna Slow Food Film Festival,
uh-huh,
which was a big festival.
Yes.
And it was like an invitation, flew me in, and it was a beautiful festival. Everything around food and farming and great films and great food too. And so I got to go there with my wife the year after. And it was very, very nice. And I'm Italian, so anytime I can go back to Italy, I'll take it.
I know. I feel the same way. I'm also Italian. You know, I couldn't ask this of everybody, but I can of you, and I should go to break, but let's try and squeeze it in. Raking leaves. You like raking leaves. Now, I'll tell you something. I always liked raking leaves, and the reason I discovered that I did is that I could sort of, I could go to the world where I needed to be to think and imagine. Is that why you like raking leaves, or is it?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, you nailed it. That's the, it's just like such a robotic action. It just clears the mind and allows you to get into some other dimension or some other space that you can really clear out from anything. And maybe that's when you're going to have this idea that leads you somewhere to a film or something bigger. So yeah, I love that. So nice workout.
Yes, that too. You know, I've always wondered about why I felt that way, but I found a kindred spirit. Now I feel completely justified. So we're going to take a break now, Diego. We're talking to Diego Angaro, who is French-Italian writer, director, living in Western Massachusetts. And when we come back, we're going to talk about his feature-length film that's going to Sundance, Bob and the Trees. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. Societies do change, thank goodness, and because our societies have changed so rapidly, some of today's admirable films already have a kind of vintage feel to them. Today's film tells of a seemingly impossible but absolutely true historical event. At its core, Pride is a tale of the gay experience in the broadest of terms, from a time when gay was far from acceptable. We remember the early days when light barely escaped from the closet and the larger world paid little heed. Pride is about a group of gay English activists who, in 1984, sought an unusual alliance. So what's to be done to bring attention to our cause? How about supporting the striking coal miners, then victims of the union-bashing efforts of the Iron Lady's conservative government? Can't we work together, cried the gays. What? Bloody poofs in our midst? Shouted the miners. The inevitable conflict of these polar opposite groups provides the backbone of a warm and humorous true story. Pride explores the plight of the miners, gay pride, parental acceptance, AIDS, closeted shame, long-term relationships, and so much more. And it describes an extraordinary alliance which changed the course of history. Yes, mountains can be made into molehills, given enough pride. Not in theaters. Discovery through rental.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio, having a wonderful conversation with filmmaker Diego Angaro. He's a French and Italian writer, director, and of course, those who know me and know how much I love film and that I'm Italian, well, and we both like raking leaves so we can think. So having said that, tell us, do you have anything in common with Bob? I mean, Playmobil?
Yeah, first we live in the same town.
Yes.
he's a really good friend of mine. I met Bob shortly after moving in the Berkshires in Western Mass, and he's been a logger and a forester for 35 years in the area. He's a well-known character here, and we got along really well right away. We started hanging out and playing frisbee golf on his property, and he's got a farm, the same farm that you see in the film.
Yes.
And I was helping, like doing farm chores and whenever I could, even like slaughtering animals sometimes. And he's such an amazing man. And he's so different from everything I grew up with, like being in Paris, but
yes.
Just like being with Bob, aside from being a great friend, was amazing. Just like getting outside and watching him logging and hanging out around his farm and seeing how he does it, and it's pretty amazing. I mean, it's sort of more of a 20th century life, more than a 21st century life, and a life that so is almost gonna get distinguished. Too, I mean, I feel like, and he's also a very charismatic guy and very funny guy that you want to get around him.
Now, I don't know how much of the story you want to give away, so I'll tap dance around it a bit, and you can say whatever you want. But I have to say.
Okay.
Am I reading too much into it? Because my reaction was, this is, while it's certainly Western Massachusetts with a great deal of snow, and we are talking about a logger who has his own, maybe not demons, but certainly his antagonists, whether he creates them or they are created for him. But on some level, too, he's a tragic hero of Shakespearean stature, if you don't mind my saying so. Who, you know, has his flaws, but must make the arc, make the journey on his own terms. So
He's completely. I mean, he's a character that basically creates his own problem and then wants to find a solution to them on his own.
Yes.
Refuses help around, and he wants to fix everything himself.
Yes.
Until he realizes he can't.
Yes.
And in the meantime, he buries himself so low, so deep, that he can't get out on his own, and he's got to reach out to people. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting on the Shakespearean aspect of it. I mean, I never thought of it that way, but I like the comparison, and yeah. I think it's his character is going to be very relatable to people because, yeah, it's sort of this internal crisis that you have that can happen at any age, and in his case, he's in his 50s, and basically, yeah, goes down this rabbit hole and things get dark.
You know, and having said that, we do want to point out there is a great deal of humor in the movie,
mm-hmm.
particularly in the relationships, male-female, as well as the guys in the bar, and of course with his son. But one of the things that struck me as the lonely hero, if you will, much of what Bob and the Trees shows us is how the outside world economy, whether that's the entire globe or our world in Massachusetts, or any state in America, but how that external economy affects us and then how we respond to it. Ultimately, it's Bob and his power chainsaw in the woods alone.
Yeah, I agree. And thank you for pointing out the humor, because I hate dramas when they're like hitting you over the head like 100 times and everything is horrible and everyone is crying and everyone is having a terrible time, because I think every time in life there's always like a good balance of things, and I like to have a laugh too, even if things sure turn out pretty bad for characters. As far as the background of the economy, I mean, I think it was very important to me, and it's something I think it's mostly ghost-like, because you're such enclosed in this bubble in the film, which is basically his small town and
yes.
his property, basically, and his woods,
yes.
that you don't get to see anywhere else, but you can feel it there.
It's
pressuring you. And it's interesting. And I wanted to add more about the logging industry in this town, and about really interesting things, how like sometimes the globalization hits the business of logging and like local sawmills and stuff like that. But I realized I didn't have much room to put that in.
Uh-huh.
As interesting as it is, it felt unnatural sometimes. Good Bob has really great things to say about that, just because that's his work, and that's
yes.
what he has been doing for like 3-5 years. But how sometimes, for example, a lot of sawmills are running out of business because a Chinese company have like this platform set up in international waters, like 20 miles away from the U.S. coast, and they actually profit the logs there,
yes.
For an extremely small cost, and then they send it back. And yeah, how like sawmills run out of business, for example. I mean, that's just one detail, but that's crazy to mm-hmm. hear that. And that's only one of the many things that don't make sense in today's economy.
Yes.
And loggers and the wood industry is not an exception.
You know, it isn't an exception, but as you said earlier, we don't necessarily, when we think about the economy and struggling, we don't go right away to a logger or a forester. And it's great
yeah.
that your film does, because while I think Bob is an example of a lot of different people and locations making it work and working through it, even if it takes a beer or two and an F word or two, it's still working through it. It is good to see it in this framework, in that it is about a logger, because most of us don't really know about the family-owned logging company.
I agree. And this is why I started making this project. I mean, there was Bob. There was the character Bob, who I thought was extremely charismatic, and I wanted to make a film with him being a character, being a fiction character, and also explore the world of loggers, because it's such a important thing in the Berkshires and the town where I live. There's a lot of loggers, and that's something I was completely foreign to before moving here, and I find it fascinating, and I find it that you never see that in films, and it was a perfect line of work that I wanted to explore more.
Yes.
Just because because I was very curious about it too.
Sure.
When you throw a log in the fire, you have no idea. I mean, a lot of people have no idea the amount of work that's behind that. Like,
exactly.
Cutting down the trees and like processing them and like delivering them and as far as the plank of wood, you want to put more wood on the floor. Then I'm saying it's a huge process, a huge amount of work. And
yes.
I find it really interesting.
It's a huge amount of mathematics, if you will, and art and creativity. I'm not going to give away too much, but you can answer any way you wish. But I do remember as a child, my grandmama's home was this huge place. And, you know, there were 13 children, all my aunts and uncles. And of course, Italian holidays were deafening. You could not hear any one person speak because they were all speaking. But one thing I remember from that, they wanted to cut down this enormous tree that had grown up next to the house, I guess, for years. But it had reached a point where they, I guess, thought with weather or whatever, it might be a danger to the house. And all the uncles getting together and throwing a chain around it and a tractor stretching the chain its full length and then another pulling it in another direction. And then my Uncle Gino, who knew more about this than most people, starting the saw and, you know, and then they check it and then they put wedges and they all of this. And they brought that enormous tree down right next to the house without touching it. It was an amazing process. And I have to say, I never thought about that until I watched Bob and the Trees, and I went, wow, I know what he's doing, but he's out there by himself.
It's extremely dangerous. I mean, it's the second most dangerous job in America after the first being a cod fisherman in Alaska, I think.
Yes.
But it's extremely dangerous. I mean, you could have either a tree or even a branch falling on your head.
Sure.
Yeah, I know some people who passed away this way. You don't get a lot of recognition even, or even
yes.
financial recognition for the risk you're taking. So you just get to know what you're doing, and it takes a lot of machinery. I mean, you were talking about
yes.
trees and skitters and stuff like that, and science too, like how the tree leans and
yes.
taking into consideration the canopy, the where it's going to pick the tree. I mean, I'm not an expert, but it is an intense, very intense work and very dangerous kind of work.
I want to also say, even though this is about someone you actually know, and very much it is his film as well as yours, it's not what, if people are thinking it's a documentary, it's not that. It's a mixture. You seem to have created I think you actually said this. You want Bob in the film, but you want Bob also to be a character and not just Bob.
It's not a documentary. It's a pure fiction film.
Yes.
It feels like a documentary sometimes because sometimes it's just film life as it is or has it happened.
Yes.
And because Bob is not a professional actor. He makes an incredible performance in a film.
Yes.
It's a fiction film, and I think it's important. And it was very exciting for me to try to create that balance between real life and fiction.
Yes.
And be able to tell a fictional film without the plot being too present, being too visible.
Uh-huh.
Try to throw in some more real life events in there, like some like piece that would look more documentary, like this dinner, like this family dinner, for example, which is not scripted, or following these guys at work and just seeing how they work in real life without anything being scripted, and just like having a fine balance between this and more plot-driven story.
Yes,
was very interested, and I didn't know how it would work together until we cut it.
Yes,
I sort of knew.
It was in your head when you were raking the leaves. That's for sure.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we had a script. But it was not scripted. We had an outline, like a treatment, which described every scene and pretty in detail what happens, what emotions, how do we start, what character do. But as far as talking, I would let the actors use their own language and their own words, because I wanted it to sound extremely natural and yeah, hopefully it comes out together well. But I'm happy with this, with the result and the fact that some people will be confused, either as wondering if they are watching a documentary or fiction, because as the film develops, it develops more and more into fiction. And that can confuse people, but that can get people very excited about you.
I think so. I think you do one of the greatest things about this film, Bob and the Trees, is its cinematography. And then I want to dovetail that with, but you make the camera disappear. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Now,
that was one key thing for the film. To be able to for the actors to forget that camera,
yes,
and to work with small enough cameras that were good enough to capture the landscape and the snow and the scenery, and also that was something small and inobtrusive, so that the actors and the non-professional actors and the characters in the film can sometimes forget the camera and forget that they're in this big film.
Yes.
And they have a whole crew around them. I mean, it was really important to me to sort of find that balance and have that fly on the wall kind of to it.
Sure. And then at the same time, what the camera sees and allows us to see is absolutely beautiful. And, you know, film is telling a story with pictures, but you do it so extremely well. Who is your cinematographer?
I had a lot of help with the cinematography. I mean, we actually have two cinematographers that they co-signed the film together. They're very good friends in real life, and then they wanted to try working together on that film because we needed two cameras rolling all the time. And I wanted to keep the crew as small as possible, so they needed to operate the cameras. So the cinematographers are Chris Teague and Danny Vicchioni. Chris is a very successful cinematographer. He's had a lot of films in Sundance already. He had two last year, including Obvious Child. He's got two this year. He's a regular. He's a very talented guy. That's gonna do very well. And I shot the short film with him actually, and it was so amazing to work together because he understands, and we have sort of similar taste, and it was a really key person that I was able to do this project with. Him and Danny did an incredible job. I mean, when I look at the films and the landscapes and the scenery, I think it looks so tremendous, and I couldn't have hoped for anything better.
Yes, a better picture, that's for sure. We've talked about the various elements and antagonists that Bob has to deal with. He does have allies. He's got a good family. And back in the day when people didn't just rely on television for their entertainment, but they actually entertained each other with stories, it gets a lot of humor from that and any improvisation. But they're farm animals and the challenges of that. But I, without giving it away, there is one very specific antagonist that is a surprising one, especially for those of us who know very little about logging, that Bob has to deal with. And it is a battle of wits. It is a battle. It's a war. And we'll just have to go see the movie to see who wins. Before we go, and it's been absolutely delightful, Diego, tell us, how do we find out more about Bob and the Trees? Where can we see it? Do we have to wait for Sundance, and if you're not as lucky as I am, and get a screener?
The world premiere is going to be at Sundance, so for people who can make it there, people who are lucky enough to be able to be there, we're going to have five screenings there in Park City and Salt Lake City. You can look at the times on the Sundance website. They're all listed there. And after that, I am not sure yet. I mean, we're hoping to get into some festivals. So you have to stay tuned to the website of Bob and the Trees or the Facebook page. So we have a website that's Bob and the Trees. .com, and we have a Facebook page which is Bob and the Trees Film, which also gives all the updates as for excerpts or trailers or screenings, upcoming screenings and festivals.
Fantastic. And I would add just one last thing as a personal note from me: pay close attention to the lyrics of the closing song. I'll just say that. Diego, no.
Thank you for pointing it out.
Yes. Well, Diego, this has been fabulous, and I wish you all the very best. I can't help but wish I was there with you in Sundance. Who knows? But I'm glad you're going, and it's fantastic to have had this conversation. Wish you all the best with Bob and the trees and your entire team, your production team.
Thank you so much, Marcel.
Take care.
Thank you so much. I will see you. Great to talk with you.
All right. Bye now.
Stay with us, as we'll be right back with a final comment from The Reasonable Voice.
And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. The world fell in love with dolphins when Flipper was such a TV star in the 1960s. Intelligent creatures, and look, he'll pull you through the waves if you hang on his fin. Charming, and ultimately deadly to the world's dolphin population. Rick O'Berry was Flipper's trainer. He eventually came to believe that interference with these intelligent creatures was unacceptable. In 2007, he led a group of environmental activists on a dangerous mission to infiltrate a secret cove near Taiji in Japan, site of an annual dolphin slaughter. Using underwater cameras and microphones, the crew was constantly threatened by guards determined to keep the slaughter a secret. An annual dolphin migration is the target of the Taiji fishermen who herd them into the cove, where they are trapped and brutally slaughtered, saving only a few for sale to aquariums and tourist dolphin swims. The cove turns red with the blood of thousands of marine mammals. The air is filled with their screams. The cove horrified audiences around the world, but the needless slaughter continues despite the efforts of O'Berry and thousands of others to stop it. Think that swimming with captured dolphins is a harmless way to enjoy nature? Think again. Indie Film Minute. Not in theaters. Discovery through rental.
Hello, I'm Marcello Rolando, here with my pets and pet peeves, hoping you'll join me in a wake-up cup of coffee. America the Beautiful is not a movie. What I know about sports, I learned watching movies. But what I know about fair play and equality, I learned watching my parents. Although movies, based on a true story, have evolved closer to reality since William Bendix played Babe Ruth, the brain damage of inequality requires more than a Hail Mary pass at equal economic opportunity and justice for all to tackle an Equal Rights Amendment fumbled by a deadline for ratification. What I know about a New Jersey legislature or a Virginia General Assembly is, you're either for the people stuck on the bridge or against those seeking constitutional reality, and only those gridlocked in our historical inequality fear the dignity discovered in debate between equals. What I know about the Virginia Assembly and the Equal Rights Amendment is, non-attorney Delegate Mark L. Cole claims the Virginia General Assembly cannot legally consider the Equal Rights Amendment after the Virginia Senate passed it with the support of several attorneys, including Senators Henry Marsh and Creed Deeds. What I know about Tuesday, February 11th, 2014 is, it's the day for men to get in touch with their equal feminine side. Crossover Day is the last day for each house of the Virginia legislature to act on its own legislation, excluding revenue bills and budget bills. So it's the perfect day to call 804-698-1088 or email Delegate Mark L. Cole at delmkole@house.virginia.gov and tell him to lead Virginia by an example for what you want America to be, the greatest generation who fought World War II to save and value the culture of all people, or the America granting only white people the privilege of singing America the Beautiful in soft drink commercials. What I know about theater and politics is, while they often commingle, auditions offer equal opportunity for a role, while politics still tips the land of opportunity in favor of men making more money than women for doing the same job. What I know is the Equal Rights Amendment is an economic equality debt we failed to pay our grandmothers and their grandmothers that is now due to our mothers, wives, and daughters. What I know about those who've claimed to be a superior race is, sooner or later, history grinds them down into humility, even sometimes producing an all-inclusive pearl of acceptance in their place. What I know about the Hill and amendments is the failure of a McConnell and Boehner 113th Congress to pass S.J. Res. 15 and H.J. Res. 43 to remove the deadline for ERA ratification so smells of a plague on both your houses that in 2014 voters just might elect a new Congress that will work together for the equality of all Americans, because what I know about the Golden Rule and America is, until income reflects equality of opportunity, regardless of gender, race, age, party affiliation, or sexual persuasion, we haven't earned the gold medal for brother-sister equality, nor are we American in our skin. What we should all know about West Virginia water and corporatism is the air we breathe and all our drinking and washing water are connected to all the air and water on earth, and it is your pregnant wife, children, and grandmothers who are first sacrificed on the altar of coal, oil, CEO bonuses, corporate greed, and government corruption. What I know about you and the women in your life is, whether by corporations, EPA, NSA, in the military, university, or Peace Corps, or with an inequitable salary check, men raping women isn't about sex. It's about power, control, and intimidation. And informed women, who now know how much they matter, are not going to take it anymore. That's what I know.
Thank you for continuing to listen to, support, and share the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio with family and friends, especially online. We enjoy hearing from you, and in response, yes, we are now accepting new company and business advertisers and welcoming organizations seeking to be one of our sponsors. So please do continue to email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com. However, if you prefer to simply make a donation, your donations are greatly appreciated and can be made through PayPal by clicking on the donate button found at the top of the homepage of The Reasonable Voice. Voice.com website.
Thank you for joining us today to make every day as reasonable as possible. We hope you will download and share our downloadable podcasts. I am Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard around the world.